Hong Kong protests turn violent, and Boris Johnson begins his term as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. This is The New Diplomatist. And welcome to The New Diplomatist. My name is Garrison Morado, and I'm your host. And The New Diplomatist is a podcast dedicated to the study of foreign policy, why it's relevant, what's happening in the world, and why you should care. The format of this podcast is strictly unscripted, so I will be speaking without pre-written remarks on the subjects that we are dealing with in each episode, which in this case starts with the Hong Kong protests and the selection of Boris Johnson as the next Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. The streets of Hong Kong still covered with empty tear gas canisters and lingering smoke as that city continues to experience great domestic unrest. We have entered into a multi-week process at this point of protest, which began some time ago now in regards to the extradition bill, as it was called, which was a law that would have permitted Beijing to extradite various crimes, people guilty of those crimes, back to the mainland, which is obviously communist. And out of the democratic judicial system of laws that is in place in Hong Kong, which has been their inheritance from the time that they were a British colony, which obviously ended some 22 years ago. Although the extradition bill has since been tabled and is no longer in place of imminent enactment, there is still a significant amount of civil unrest due to counter-protests that took place, in particular last weekend, by a group of armed thugs known as the Triad, which many have accused Beijing and local government officials in Hong Kong of permitting to go through the streets and to maraud about and to attack various civilians, to beat them with batons and sticks, and all around cause mass chaos and threaten the public through violence and intimidation. This has sparked a new round of protests, which continue into this weekend and into today, stating that the protesters are stating that the government as a whole has two standards, one for those who believe in pro-Beijing policies, such as the Triad, who they permit to roam about freely and to terrorize the citizenry, and those protesters who believe in democracy and are calling to an end of Beijing's communist interference with Hong Kong politics, which of course means the iron fist of the police forces. So today, 288,000 people participated in the protests on the streets of Hong Kong against the Triad in favor of democracy. And that really is the story of these protests over the last few weeks, beginning with specific issues. We are opposed to the extradition bill. We are opposed to the use of armed gangs to do Beijing's bidding, that is the Triad. But now we start to see a continual evolution towards, rather than anti-Beijing policy, we are seeing pro-democracy. People coming forward and saying, we don't want to be like the mainland of China. We have freedom. We want to maintain our freedom. We want to expand on our freedom. The current system of Hong Kong has been dominated by the Chinese principle of one country, two systems. That is that Hong Kong is as much a part of China as Shanghai or Beijing, but they are permitted to operate under this democratic, more pro-freedom model that they inherited from the British, as mentioned earlier, 22 years ago when they were a colony. But this two-system, one country, still, this principle still promotes the idea that they must be loyal. Hong Kong must be loyal to mainland China. They must ultimately do the bidding of mainland China on macro-level issues. Which brings us to the critical foreign policy questions that involve the United States. There is so far an admirable, or some might call it admirable, level of restraint by Beijing not to roll in the troops and to crush this current sequence of rebellious and protest activity on the part of pro-democracy leaders inside of Hong Kong. However, no one knows how long that will last. Obviously, Beijing has asserted the legal authority to send in the military of the People's Republic of China, if necessary, to suppress these protests by force, to put an end to this pro-democracy movement. But there is also the aspect under consideration that Beijing wants to avoid another Tiananmen Square, which, of course, leaves a lingering sense of distrust inside of China, inside of East Asia and the world as a whole, since it took place 30 years ago this year, actually 30 years ago this summer, in 1989. That, of course, was a pro-democracy movement that took place in the heady days when Eastern Europe was becoming free, being released from communism, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the slow-motion collapse of the Soviet Union, and then there's this pro-democracy movement inside of China. It takes place in hundreds of cities around the country, brought about by a variety of factors, but with the end goal of we want democracy in China, we want freedom, and it culminated and centered upon Tiananmen Square in Beijing, and obviously, very famously, Deng Xiaoping, the leader of China at the time, sent in the tanks to finally put an end to that protest with a great deal of violence, a great deal of bloodshed, and that famous shot with the tanks running down the street at the lone individual standing there blocking their path into the square. Very famous, very moving image, along with many others. That imagery is still present in the minds of foreign policy experts and in the protesters in Hong Kong alike. Everyone's wondering, how long will Xi Jinping, the leader of China, put up with these protests? And I think it depends on a variety of factors. Number one, the actions of the United States, which thus far have been rather muted, attempting not to rock the boat. It is possible that there are various U.S. Assets on the ground attempting to promote and assist pro-democracy forces in a covert operation. Obviously, this has not been confirmed or denied by the U.S. government. If it had been, the Chinese obviously would have something to say about that. But Xi has to weigh the PR of the situation. Is it worth it to him to suppress the protests and end this ideological movement before it spreads to the mainland, before it creates malcontent inside the ranks of Chinese in other cities? Or does he allow the protests to run their course and die out naturally and therefore maintain a certain air of aloofness by the Communist Party, not giving these protesters too much credit? And allowing him to seem like a magnanimous leader who allows for a certain amount of freedom within the Hong Kong island. It's worth noting that protests are not uncommon inside of China, although they're not often publicized very well in the West. There are thousands of protests every year inside the Chinese mainland, protesting a whole range of issues, but usually they are economic, relating to some level of local policy, some level of economic policy. Perhaps a factory leaves a region, there's a labor dispute, there's a pay dispute, perhaps an infrastructure dispute. Usually these protests are centered around economic issues or specific dislike of a particular policy that has been put in place either by a regional governance structure or by Beijing. But Beijing is very adept at suppressing any movements from becoming widespread. And they do this usually by, frankly, for lack of a better term, throwing local governmental officials under the bus. They will publicly prosecute and scapegoat local officials for failing to do X, Y, or Z, or attempting to do X, Y, and Z and implementing it the wrong way. And then Beijing sets up a PR situation where their representatives step forward and announce a solution to the problem, garner a certain amount of kudos from the state-run media and press that praises Beijing for their wisdom in handling the situation and condemns the local official for failing to do so, and they remove them from power, thus directing the anger of the protesters at the locality, fixing that problem, and then directing the praise for the solution back to the national government, so further cementing the view of the public that the Communist Party is responsive to their needs and listens to them and is the best keepers of their national and regional interests. That's going to be much more difficult in Hong Kong because fundamentally the nature of these protests are ideological. The protesters are setting forth the idea that they want to live in freedom in a system of laws created by representatives that they elect and that they can hold accountable. They want to maintain autonomy. And the way that this movement is breaking is not only do they want democracy to be maintained as the island's system in accordance with the one country, two systems policy, but they actually are starting to hint at, we don't even want to be a part of your country. We want to be our own country. Perhaps something along the lines of Singapore, a city-state model, a very financially savvy, very prosperous, very tech-centered, Western-style Asian democracy with a booming economy and a great deal of state control and oversight, but nonetheless a democracy with their own laws from their own elected officials and free of the influence of Beijing. Something perhaps along the lines of Singapore meets Taiwan. So it will be interesting to see what the ultimate endgame of the protesters truly is as the coming days and weeks unfold, and how long Xi Jinping's restraint will last. But it's something we'll keep an eye on in this podcast, and something that the American media as a whole, I hope, will continue to cover, and we'll continue to analyze in the days and weeks ahead. And finally today, let's talk about Boris Johnson, who was recently selected by the Conservative Party members as the next Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Mr. Johnson comes into power at a very interesting time in British history. Of course, the issue of Brexit is still dominant, but also a variety of regional and international challenges that extend far beyond merely their exit from the European Union, foremost of which is the continuing crisis surrounding the Iranian seizure of a British-flagged tanker in the Strait of Hormuz, as well as their relationship with Donald Trump in the United States, and the personal enmity that has begun to take place between leaders of the United Kingdom and leaders of the European Union over the negotiations regarding Brexit that will last far beyond the time period in which Britain leaves the EU. It's something that is boiling down to a fundamental lack of trust between the continent and the British Isles. However, the 55-year-old, who was previously foreign minister as well as mayor of London, does approach various issues differently than many other leaders in public office. He really could not be any different than his predecessor if he tried. Theresa May being always more the detailed, quiet, more mild-mannered leader that had served loyally on the front benches of Parliament for many, many years. Boris being more the outlandish and go-it-alone style maverick in politics, who oftentimes has had to face significant media firestorm for various comments, but has also endeared himself to the so-called forgotten men of Britain in a way not too dissimilar to that of Donald Trump, although on policies they're actually quite different. But he opened his time as Prime Minister with a rather rousing speech in front of No. 10 Downing Street, with several notable pledges, among them that he would begin to bring to the streets of England 20,000 new police officers, 20 new hospital upgrades that he promised would reduce the waiting time to see general practitioners, and also fixing the crisis in social care in order to protect parents and grandparents, as he says, quote, from the fear of having to sell their home to pay for the costs of care, unquote. And it was very interesting to watch his speech because although Brexit, again, is his primary concern for the coming months between now and October, when they're supposed to leave the European Union formally under the new deadline set forward under Theresa May, he is also very clearly positioning himself, unlike his predecessor, as someone who will be defined by the whole range of issues facing a government leader, not merely Brexit, but also education, also security, also the economy, and the other issues that commonly take up a prime minister's time, like foreign policy, like healthcare, and like the issues of internal cohesion within the United Kingdom, with England and Northern Ireland and Scotland and, of course, Wales. He further set forward a very unequivocal stance that he would be leading Britain in a way that was unapologetic. He reinstated an idea that Britain is not just existing within 2019, 3 years into what would be described as many as a Brexit crisis. He sets the entire tone for his government in the realm of history, that they are the nation that has ruled the waves in the past, that had a global empire, that has always been a nation that was outward-looking, that can boast of its culture, of its economy, of its humor, of its wit, of its parliamentary democracy, of its values, of its military strength, and of its, frankly, for lack of a better word, its goodness on the world stage towards other nations and the example that it has set. And he did not take anything off the table in terms of what the British can do. He repeatedly cited that the naysayers would be proven wrong, and that the issues that were facing Britain really were not the decisions that were made regarding Brexit, but rather the fact that there were no final concrete decisions made in regards to Brexit, and that In his words, quote, after 3 years of unfounded self-doubt, it is time to change the record, to recover our natural and historic role as an enterprising, outward-looking, and truly global Britain, generous in temper and engaged with the world. No one in the last few centuries has succeeded in betting against the pluck and nerve and ambition of this country. They will not succeed today. We in this government will work flat out to give this country the leadership it deserves, and that work begins now, unquote. And so he definitely sets forward a very optimistic, semi-defiant, but determined and, I would say, even focused outlook, not only towards Brexit, but towards restoring national morale, which has sagged considerably under the leadership of Theresa May and the gridlock that she has faced in Parliament with her Brexit deal having failed three times to secure the number of votes necessary to enact it into treaty. Of course, there will still be significant challenges to Boris Johnson achieving any of this agenda. He, number one, faces a slim parliamentary majority dependent on the Democratic Unionist Party from Northern Ireland to produce a confidence and supply agreement for any of the major votes he will need to undertake. He faces an emboldened and rowdy opposition under Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn. He faces an intractable EU negotiating team who will also feel, in their own right, vindicated at having stuck to their guns regarding the agreement for Brexit. They feel like they've pushed out one British Prime Minister. What is it to push out a second? They have already indicated they are not willing to revisit and renegotiate much, if not all, of the treaty that was already offered and settled with Theresa May, stating that not only is this the best deal Britain will get, it is the only deal that Britain will get. And of course, Boris has reserved the right for a no-deal Brexit, that is to leave without a formal agreement with the EU, to crash out, as some have said, under World Trade Organization rules. But there's a great deal of debate in Britain as to whether or not that will cause an economic depression. Some have even said an economic collapse. Others have said it will barely even be a blip on the radar. There's a great deal of debate as to what is possible economically and what is not possible for Britain in the weeks and months ahead. But he faces a parliament who is going to restrict his running room, who is going to want to be consulted at every turn in ways they feel that Theresa May did not. He's going to face a parliament that will seek to take a no-deal Brexit off the table permanently, therefore restricting his hands for negotiations with the continent. He's going to face European leaders who have grown emboldened after the results of their local elections that they are safe from a movement that in 2016 looked like it might tear Europe apart, that nationalism might succeed over the European ideal. And instead, now they find themselves, I'm thinking particularly of Macron and of Merkel in Germany, Macron, of course, being president of France, find themselves emboldened that they can stand for the EU and point to the relative stability of the European Union's economic outlook compared to that of Britain, and to use that as leverage in the negotiations with Boris Johnson. Of course, also in foreign policy, he will face an intractable Iran. He will face a president of the United States that many find difficult to predict what he will do or not do. And even if he is successful in bringing the UK out of the EU in October of this year or sooner, he will face the long and arduous task of beginning to rebuild a British foreign policy that has been outsourced economically to the continent for decades now. And he will need to strike free trade deals with Australia, with New Zealand, with other Commonwealth countries, with Japan, with China, with Europe, and of course with the United States. So definitely something to keep watching in the days and weeks ahead. That's all for now, and until next time, thank you so much for tuning into The New Diplomatist. I'm Garrison Morado, bidding you a good weekend.